The Fronde failed. Louis XIV did mount the throne of France, and Mazarin, though briefly removed, was quickly reinstated, presiding as Prime Minister until his death in 1660. The Prairie documents had asserted that Sion actively opposed Mazarin. They also asserted that certain families and titles, Lorraine, for example, Gonzaga, Nevers, Guise, Longueville, and Bouillon, had not only been intimately connected with the order, but also provided it with some of its grand masters. And history confirmed that it was these names and titles which had loomed in the forefront of resistance to the cardinal. It thus seemed that we had located the Prairie de Sion, and that we had identified at least some of its members. If we were right, Sion, during the period in question at any rate, was simply another name for a movement and a conspiracy which historians had long recognized and acknowledged. But if the Frondeurs constituted an enclave of opposition to Mazarin, they were not the only such enclave. The Prairie documents themselves refer repeatedly and insistently to the Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement. They imply quite clearly that the Compagnie was in fact Sion, or a facade for Sion operating under another name. The Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement was a highly organized and efficient secret society. There's no question of it being fictitious. On the contrary, its existence had been acknowledged by its contemporaries as well as by subsequent historians. It has been exhaustively documented, and numerous books and articles have been devoted to it. The Compagnie is said to have been founded between 1627 and 1629 by a nobleman associated with Gaston d'Orléans. The individuals who guided and shaped its policies remained anonymous, and are still so today. The only names definitely associated with it are those of intermediate or lower-ranking members of its hierarchy, the frontmen, so to speak, who acted on instructions from above. One of these was the brother of the Duchess of Longueville. Another was Charles Fouquet, brother of Louis XIV's superintendent of finances. In its organization and activities, the Compagnie echoed the Order of the Temple and prefigured later Freemasonry. Working from Saint-Sulpice, it established an intricate network of provincial branches or chapters. Provincial members remained ignorant of their directors' identities. They were often manipulated on behalf of objectives they themselves did not share. They were even forbidden to contact each other except via Paris, thus ensuring a highly centralized control. And even in Paris, the architects of the society remained unknown to those who obediently served them. The Compagnie comprised a hydra-headed organization with an invisible heart. To this day, it is not known who constituted the heart, nor what constituted the heart. But it is known that the heart beat in accordance with some veiled and weighty secret. So far as uninitiated novice members were concerned, the Compagnie was ostensibly devoted to charitable work. It is now generally accepted, however, that this charitable work was merely a convenient façade which had little to do with the Compagnie's raison d'être. The raison d'être was twofold: to engage in what was called pious espionage, and to infiltrate the most important offices in the land, including circles in direct proximity to the throne. In both of these objectives, the Compagnie seems to have enjoyed a signal success. By the mid-17th century, it could wield power through the aristocracy, the parliament, the judiciary, and the police, so much so that on a number of occasions these bodies openly dared to defy the king. In our researches, we found no historian who adequately explained the Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement. Most authorities depict it as a militant arch-Catholic organization that devoted itself to weeding out heretics. But why, in a devoutly Catholic country, should such an organization have had to function with such strict secrecy? And who constituted a heretic at that time? Protestants? Jansenists? In fact, there were numerous Protestants and Jansenists within the ranks of the Compagnie. If the Compagnie was piously Catholic, it should, in theory, have endorsed Cardinal Mazarin, who, after all, embodied Catholic interests at the time. Yet the Compagnie militantly opposed Mazarin. So much so that the cardinal, losing his temper, vowed he would employ all his resources to destroy it. What is more, the Compagnie provoked vigorous hostility in other conventional quarters as well. The Jesuits, for instance, assiduously campaigned against it. Other Catholic authorities accused the Compagnie of heresy, the very thing the Compagnie itself purported to oppose. In 1651, the Bishop of Toulouse charged the Compagnie with impious practices and hinted at something highly irregular in its induction ceremonies. He even threatened members of the society with excommunication. Most of them brazenly defied this threat, an extremely singular response from supposedly pious Catholics. In 1660, the year before Mazarin's death, the king officially pronounced against the Compagnie and ordered its dissolution. For the next 5 years, the Compagnie cavalierly ignored the royal edict. At last, in 1665, it concluded that it could not continue to operate in its present form. Accordingly, all documents pertinent to the society were recalled and concealed in some secret Paris depository. This depository has never been located, although it is generally believed to have been Saint Sulpice. If it was, the Compagnie's archives would have been available more than two centuries later to men like Abbé Émile Offay. But though the Compagnie ceased to exist in what was then its present form, it continued to operate at least until the beginning of the next century. According to unconfirmed traditions, it survived well into the 20th century. In the Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement, we thus found an actual secret society, much of whose history was on record. It was ostensibly Catholic, but was linked with distinctly un-Catholic activities. It was intimately associated with certain important aristocratic families, families who had been active in the Fronde and whose genealogies figured in the Prieuré documents. It was closely connected with Saint-Sulpice. It worked primarily by infiltration and came to exercise enormous influence, and it was actively opposed to Cardinal Mazarin. In all these respects, it conformed almost perfectly to the image of the Prieuré de Sion as presented in the Prieuré documents. If Sion was indeed active during the 17th century, we could reasonably assume it to have been synonymous with the Compagnie, or perhaps with the power behind the Compagnie. Mazarin had other enemies beside the Frondeurs and the Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement. Among the most powerful of them was Nicolas Fouquet, who in 1653 had become superintendent of finances to Louis XIV. A gifted, precocious, and ambitious man, Fouquet, within the next few years, had become the wealthiest and most powerful individual in the kingdom. He was sometimes called the true King of France. Fouquet's mother was a prominent member of the Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement. So was his brother Charles, Archbishop of Narbonne in the Languedoc. In 1661, Louis XIV ordered the arrest of Nicolas Fouquet. The charges were extremely general and nebulous. There were vague accusations of misappropriation of funds, and others, even more vague, of sedition. On the basis of these accusations, all Fouquet's goods and properties were placed under royal sequestration. But the king forbade his officers to touch the superintendent's papers or correspondence. He insisted on sifting through these documents himself, in private. The ensuing trial dragged on for 4 years and became the sensation of France at the time, violently splitting and polarizing public opinion. The superintendent's mother and brother mobilized the Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement. The Compagnie threw the whole of its support behind the superintendent, working actively through the courts and the popular mind. Louis XIV demanded nothing less than the death sentence. Refusing to be intimidated by him, the court passed a sentence of perpetual banishment. Still demanding death, the enraged king removed the recalcitrant judges and replaced them with others more obedient. But the Compagnie still seems to have defied him. Eventually, in 1665, Fouquet was sentenced to perpetual imprisonment. On the king's orders, he was kept in rigorous isolation. He was forbidden all writing implements, all means whereby he might communicate with anyone, and any soldiers who conversed with him were allegedly consigned to prison ships, or in some cases, hanged. In 1665, the year of Fouquet's imprisonment, Nicolas Poussin died in Rome. During the years that followed, Louis XIV endeavoured to obtain a single painting, Les Bergers d'Acadie. In 1685, he finally managed to do so. The painting was sequestered in the king's private apartments, where no one could view it without the monarch's personal authority. Poussin himself was born in 1594 in a small town called Les Anglis, a few miles from Gisors. As a young man, he left France and established residence in Rome, where he spent the duration of his life, returning only once to France in the early 1640s at the request of Cardinal Richelieu, who had invited him to undertake a specific commission. Although he was not actively involved in politics, Poussin was in fact closely associated with the Fronde. His correspondence of the period reveals him to have been deeply committed to the anti-Mazarin movement, and on surprisingly familiar terms with a number of influential Frondeurs. We had already traced the motifs of the underground stream of Arcadia and Arcadian shepherds to René d'Anjou. We now undertook to find an antecedent for the specific phrase in Poussin's painting, Et in Arcadia ego. It appeared in an earlier painting by Poussin, in which the tomb is surmounted by a skull and does not constitute an edifice of its own, but is embedded in the side of a cliff. In the foreground of this painting, a bearded water deity reposes in an attitude of brooding moroseness, the river god Alpheus, lord of the underground stream. The work dates from 1630 or 1635, 5 or 10 years earlier than the more familiar version of Les Bergers d'Arcadie. The phrase, Et in Arcadia ego, made its public debut between 1618 and 1623 in a painting by Giovanni Francesco Guercino, a painting which constitutes the real basis for Poussin's work. In Guercino's painting, two shepherds, entering a clearing in a forest, have just happened upon a stone sepulchre. It bears the now famous inscription, and there is a large skull resting on top of it. Whatever the symbolic significance of this work, Guercino himself raised a number of questions. Not only was he well versed in esoteric tradition, he also seems to have been conversant with the lore of secret societies, and some of his other paintings deal with themes of a specifically Masonic character. A good 20 years before lodges started proliferating in England and Scotland. Whatever the origin of the phrase, Et in Arcadia ego seems for both Guercino and Poussin to have been more than a line of elegiac poetry. It seems to have enjoyed some important secret significance, which was recognizable to certain other people, the equivalent of a Masonic sign or password. In 1738, Pope Clement XII issued a papal bull condemning and excommunicating all Freemasons whom he pronounced enemies of the Roman Church. It has never been altogether clear why they should have been regarded as such, especially as many of them were ostensibly Catholic. Some light may be shed on the matter by a letter released and published for the first time in 1962. This letter had been written by Pope Clement XII and addressed to an unknown correspondent. In its text, the Pope declares that Masonic thought rests on a heresy we had encountered repeatedly before, the denial of Jesus's divinity. And he further asserts that the guiding spirits behind Freemasonry are the same as those who provoked the Lutheran Reformation. The Pope may have been paranoid, but it is important to note that he is not speaking of nebulous currents of thought or vague traditions. On the contrary, he is speaking of a highly organized group of individuals, a secret society, who through the ages have dedicated themselves to subverting the edifice of Catholic Christianity. In the late 18th century, when different Masonic systems were proliferating wildly, the so-called Oriental Rite of Memphis made its appearance. In this rite, the name Ormus occurred, to our knowledge for the first time, the name allegedly adopted by the Prieuré Sion between 1188 and 1307. According to the Oriental Rite of Memphis, Ormus was an Egyptian sage who, around AD 46, amalgamated pagan and Christian mysteries, and, in so doing, founded the Rose Croix. In other 18th century Masonic rites, there are repeated references to the Rock of Sion. We had previously assumed that the Rock of Sion was simply Mount Sion, the high hill south of Jerusalem on which Godefroy built an abbey to house the order which became the Prieuré de Sion. But Masonic sources ascribe an additional significance to the Rock of Sion. Given their preoccupation with the Temple of Jerusalem, it's not surprising that they refer one to specific passages in the Bible. And in these passages, the Rock of Sion is a particular stone overlooked or unjustifiably neglected during the building of the temple, which must subsequently be retrieved and incorporated as the structure's keystone. According to Psalm 118, for example, the stone which the builders refused is become the headstone of the corner. In Matthew chapter 21, verse 42, Jesus alludes specifically to this psalm. "Did ye never read in the scriptures, the stone which the builders rejected, the same is become the head of the corner?" In Romans chapter 9, verse 33, there is another reference, rather more ambiguous. "Behold, I lay in Sion a stumbling stone and rock of offence, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed." In Acts chapter 4, verse 11, the Rock of Sion might well be interpreted as a metaphor for Jesus himself. "By the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, doth this man stand here before you whole. This is the stone which was set at naught of your builders, which is become the head of the corner." In Ephesians chapter 2, verse 20, the equation of Jesus with the Rock of Sion becomes more apparent. "Built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone." And in Peter, chapter 2, verses 3 through 8, this equation is made even more explicit. "The Lord is gracious, to whom coming as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious. Ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house, an holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. Wherefore it is also contained in the scripture, Behold, I lay in Sion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he that believeth on him shall not be confounded. Unto you therefore which believe he is precious, but unto them which be disobedient, the stone which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner, and a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offence, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient, whereunto also they were appointed." In the very next verse, the text goes on to stress themes whose significance did not become apparent to us until later. It speaks of an elect line of kings who are both spiritual and secular leaders, a line of priest kings. "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, an holy nation, a peculiar people." What were we to make of these baffling passages? What were we to make of the Rock of Sion, the keystone of the temple, which seemed to figure so saliently among the inner secrets of Freemasonry? What were we to make of the explicit identification of this keystone with Jesus himself? And what were we to make of that royal tradition, which, because founded on the Rock of Sion or on Jesus himself, was equal to the reigning dynasties of Europe during the Crusades? In 1833, Jean-Baptiste Pitois was an official in the Ministry of Public Education, and in that year, the ministry undertook an ambitious project to publish all hitherto suppressed documents pertinent to the history of France. Two committees were formed to preside over the enterprise. These committees included, among others, Victor Hugo, Jules Michelet, and an authority on the Crusades, Baron Emmanuel Rey. Among the works subsequently published under the auspices of the Ministry of Public Education was Michelet's monumental Les Procès des Templiers, an exhaustive compilation of Inquisition records dealing with the trials of the Knights Templar. Under the same auspices, Baron Rey published a number of works dealing with the Crusades and the Frankish Kingdom of Jerusalem. In these works, there appeared in print for the first time original charters pertaining to the Prieuré de Sion. At certain points, the texts Rey quotes are almost verbatim with passages in the Prieuré documents. In 1875, Baron Rey co-founded the Société de l'Orient Latin, Society of the Latin or Frankish Middle East. Based in Geneva, this society devoted itself to ambitious archaeological projects. It also published its own magazine, the Revue de l'Orient Latin. The Revue reproduced a number of additional charters of the Prieuré de Sion. Ray's research was typical of a new form of historical scholarship appearing in Europe at the time, most prominently in Germany, which constituted an extremely serious threat to the Church. In the past, historical research had been, for the most part, an unreliable affair, resting on legend and tradition, on personal memoirs, on exaggerations promulgated for the sake of one or another cause. Only in the 19th century did German scholars begin introducing the rigorous, meticulous techniques that are now accepted as commonplace. Such preoccupation with critical examination, with investigation of first-hand sources, with cross-references and exact chronology, established the conventional stereotype of the Teutonic pedant. But if German writers of the period tended to lose themselves in minutiae, they also provided a solid basis for inquiry. It was only a matter of time before the techniques of German scholarship were applied with similar diligence to the Bible. And the Church, which rested on unquestioning acceptance of dogma, was well aware that the Bible itself could not withstand such critical scrutiny. The Catholic modernist movement arose initially as a response to this new challenge. Its original objective was to produce a generation of ecclesiastical experts trained in the German tradition who could defend the literal truth of Scripture with all the heavy ordnance of critical scholarship. As it transpired, however, the plan backfired. The more the Church sought to equip its younger clerics with the tools for combat in the modern polemical world, the more those same clerics began to desert the cause for which they'd been recruited. And by the end of the century, the modernists were no longer the elite shock troops the Church had hoped they would be, but defectors and incipient heretics. The hotbed for modernist activity was Saint-Sulpice in Paris. From Saint-Sulpice, modernist attitudes spread rapidly to the rest of France, and to Italy and Spain. According to these attitudes, biblical texts were not unimpugnably authoritative, but had to be understood in the specific context of their time. And the modernists also rebelled against the increasing centralization of ecclesiastical power, especially the recently instituted doctrine of papal infallibility, which ran flagrantly counter to the new trend. Before long, modernist attitudes were being disseminated not only by intellectual clerics, but by distinguished and influential writers as well. The Church responded with predictable vigor and wrath. In 1903, Pope Leo XIII established the Pontifical Biblical Commission to monitor the work of scriptural scholars. In 1907, Pope Pius X issued a formal condemnation of modernism. And on September 1, 1910, the Church demanded of its clerics an oath against modernist tendencies. In the meantime, modernism spread to Britain, where it was warmly welcomed and endorsed by the Anglican Church. Among its Anglican adherents was William Temple, later Archbishop of Canterbury, who declared that modernism is what most educated people already believe. One of Temple's associates was Canon A. L. Lilly, and Lilly knew the priest from whom we had received that portentous letter, which spoke of incontrovertible proof that Jesus did not die on the cross. Lilly, as we knew, had worked for some time in Paris, where he made the acquaintance of the Abbé Émile Offet, the man to whom Saunier brought the parchments found at Rennes-le-Château. With his expertise in history, language, and linguistics, Offet was the typical young modernist scholar of his age. He had not been trained at Saint-Sulpice, however. On the contrary, he had been trained in Lorraine, at the seminary school of Sion, La Colline Inspirée. While we pursued our independent research, new Prieuré documents had continued to appear. Some of them, privately printed works like the Dossier Secret and intended for limited circulation, were made available to us through the offices of friends in France or through the Bibliothèque Nationale. Others appeared in book form, newly published and released on the market for the first time. In some of these works, there was additional information on the late 19th century, and specifically on Béranger Saunier. According to one such updated account, Saunier did not discover the fateful parchments in his church by accident. On the contrary, He is said to have been directed to them by emissaries of the Prieuré de Sion, who visited him at Rennes-le-Château and enlisted him as their factotum. In late 1916, Saunière is reported to have defied the emissaries of Sion and quarrelled with them. If this is true, the curé's death in January 1917 acquires a more sinister quality than is generally ascribed to it. 10 days before his death, he had been in satisfactory health. Nevertheless, a coffin was ordered on his behalf. The receipt for the coffin, dated January 12, 1917, is made out to Saunière's confidant and housekeeper, Marie Denanot. A more recent, and if anything more apparently authoritative, Prieuré publication elaborates further on Saunière's story, and would seem to confirm, at least in part, the account just summarized. According to this publication, Saunière himself was little more than a pawn, and his role in the mystery of Rennes-le-Château has been much exaggerated. The real force behind the events at the mountain village is said to have been Saunière's friend, the Abbé Henri Boudet, curé of the adjacent village of Rennes-les-Bains. Boudet is said to have provided Saunière with all his money, a total of 13 million francs between 1887 and 1915. And Boudet is said to have guided Saunière on his various projects, the public works, the construction of the Villa Batania, and the tour Magdala. According to this recent Prieuré publication, Saunière remained essentially ignorant of the real secret for which he acted as custodian, until Boudet, in the throes of approaching death, confided it to him in March 1915. According to the same publication, Marie Denanot, Saunière's housekeeper, was in fact Boudet's agent. It was through her that Boudet supposedly transmitted instructions to Saunière, and it was to her that all money was made payable, or rather, most money. For Boudet, between 1885 and 1901, is said to have paid more than 7 million francs to the Bishop of Carcassonne, the man who at his own expense dispatched Saunière to Paris with the parchments. The bishop, too, would seem then to have been essentially in Boudet's employ. It is certainly an incongruous situation, an important regional bishop being the paid servitor of a humble backwater parish priest. And the parish priest himself? For whom was Boudet working? What interests did he represent? These questions are not answered explicitly, but the answer is constantly implicit. The Prieuré de Sion. Further light on the matter was shed by another recent work, which, like its predecessors, seemed to draw on privileged sources of information. The work in question is Le Trésor du Triangle d'Or, The Treasure of the Golden Triangle, by Jean-Luc Chaumet, published in 1979. According to Monsieur Chaumet, a number of clerics involved in the enigma of Rennes-le-Château, Saunière, Boudet, quite probably others like Offay's uncle at Saint-Sulpice, and the Bishop of Carcassonne, were affiliated with a form of Scottish Rite Freemasonry. This Freemasonry, Monsieur Chaumet declares, differed from most other forms in that it was Christian, hermetic, and aristocratic. In short, it did not, like many rites of Freemasonry, consist primarily of freethinkers and atheists. On the contrary, it seems to have been deeply religious and magically oriented, emphasizing a sacred social and political hierarchy, a divine order, an underlying cosmic plan. And the upper grades or degrees of this Freemasonry, according to Monsieur Chaumet, were the lower grades or degrees of the Prieuré de Sion. Although Monsieur Chaumet is both vague and evasive, he implies that in the years prior to 1914, the Freemasonry, of which Boudet and Saunière were members, became amalgamated with another esoteric institution. The institution in question was called the Hérons du Val d'Or, a secret political society founded around 1873. It seems to have shared much with other esoteric organizations of the period. There was, for example, a characteristic emphasis on sacred geometry and various sacred sites. There was an insistence on a mystical or Gnostic truth underlying mythological motifs. There was a preoccupation with the origins of men, races, languages, and symbols, such as occurs in Theosophy, and like many other sects and societies of the time, the Iron du Val d'Or was simultaneously Christian and trans-Christian. It sought to reconcile Christian and pagan mysteries. For the purposes of our inquiry, the Iron du Val d'Or proved relevant by virtue of its formulation of what Monsieur Chaumet calls an esoteric geopolitics and an ethnarchical world order. Translated into more mundane terms, this entailed, in effect, the establishment of a new Holy Roman Empire in 19th century Europe, a secular state that unified all peoples and rested ultimately on spiritual rather than social, political, or economic foundations. Such a state would have realized the centuries-old dream of a heavenly kingdom on earth, a terrestrial replica or mirror image of the order, harmony, and hierarchy of the cosmos. It would have actualized the ancient Hermetic premise, as above, so below. And it was not altogether utopian or naive. On the contrary, it was at least remotely feasible in the context of late 19th century Europe. According to Monsieur Chaumet, the objectives of the Iron du Val d'Or were a theocracy wherein nations would be no more than provinces, their leaders but proconsuls in the service of a world occult government consisting of an elite. For Europe, this regime of the great king implied a double hegemony of the papacy and the empire, of the Vatican and of the Habsburgs, who would have been the Vatican's right arm. By the 19th century, of course, the Habsburgs were synonymous with the House of Lorraine. Monsieur Chaumet does not clarify the extent, if any, to which the Habsburgs themselves were actively involved in these ambitious clandestine designs. There is a quantity of evidence, however, including the visit of a Habsburg archduke to Rennes-le-Château, which seemingly attests to at least some implication. But whatever plans were afoot, they would have been thwarted by the First World War, which, among other things, toppled the Habsburgs from power. As Monsieur Chaumet explained them, the objectives of the Iron du Val d'Or, or of the Prieuré de Sion, made a certain logical sense in the context of what we discovered. They concurred with the stated objectives of various secret societies, including those of Charles Radcliffe and Charles Nodier. Most important of all, they conformed to the political aspirations which, through the centuries, we had traced in the House of Lorraine. But if the Iron du Val d'Or's objectives made logical sense, they did not make practical political sense. On what basis, we wondered, would the Habsburgs have asserted their right to function as a dynasty of priest kings? Such a right could not possibly have been asserted against the republican government of France, not to mention the imperial dynasties then presiding over Russia, Germany, and Britain. And how could the necessary popular support have been obtained? In the context of 19th century political realities, such a scheme seemed to us effectively absurd. Perhaps, we concluded, the members of the Iron du Val d'Or were quite simply potty. Until we obtained further information, we had no choice but to shelve the matter. In the meantime, we turned our attention to the present, to determine whether the Prieuré de Sion existed today. As we quickly discovered, it did. Its members were not at all potty, and they were pursuing in the post-war 20th century a program essentially similar to that pursued in the 19th by the Iron du Val d'Or. The French Journal Officiel is a weekly government publication in which all groups, societies, and organizations in the country must declare themselves. In the Journal Officiel for the week of July the 20th, 1956, there is the following entry. Declaration to the sub-prefecture of Saint-Julien-en-Genevois, Prieuré de Sion. Objectives? Studies and mutual aid to members. Head office? Sous-Casson, en Mars, Haute-Savoie. The Prieuré de Sion was officially registered with the police. Here, at any rate, appeared to be definitive proof of its existence in our own age. Even though we found it somewhat odd that a supposedly secret society should thus broadcast itself. But perhaps it was not so odd after all. There was no listing for the Prieuré de Sion in any French telephone directory. The address proved too vague to allow us to identify a specific house, building, or even street. and the sub-prefecture, when we rang them, were of little help. There had been numerous inquiries, they said, with weary, long-suffering resignation, but they could provide no further information. As far as they knew, the address was untraceable. The sub-prefecture, at our request, provided us with a copy of what purported to be the Prairie des Sciences statutes. This document, which consisted of 21 articles, was neither controversial nor particularly illuminating. It did not, for example, clarify the order's objectives. It gave no indication of Sion's possible influence, membership, or resources. On the whole, it was rather bland, while at the same time compounding our perplexity. At one point, for instance, the statutes declared that admission to the order was not to be restricted on the basis of language, social origin, class, or political ideology. At another point, they stipulated that all Catholics over the age of 21 were eligible for candidature. Indeed, the statutes in general appeared to have issued from a piously, even fervently, Catholic institution. And yet, Sion's alleged Grand Masters and past history, insofar as we've been able to trace them, hardly attested to any Orthodox Catholicism. The contradiction seemed to make no sense, unless Sion, like the Knights Templar and the Compagnie du Saint-Sacrement, demanded Catholicism as an exoteric prerequisite, which might then be transcended within the order. According to Article 7 of the statutes, the candidate must renounce his personality in order to devote himself to the service of a high moral apostolate. Perhaps the most interesting information in the statutes is that since 1956, the Prairie des Sciences was seen to have expanded its membership almost fivefold. According to a page reproduced in the Dossier Secrets, printed sometime before 1956, Sion had a total of 1,093 members, ranked in 7 grades. The structure was traditionally pyramidal. At the top was the Grand Master, or Notonnier. There were 3 in the grade below him, Prince Noachite de Notre-Dame, 9 in the grade below that, Croisé de Saint-Jean. Each grade from here downwards was 3 times as large as the grade before it, 27, 81, 243, 729. The 3 highest grades, the Grand Master and his 12 immediate subordinates, were said to constitute the 13 Rose Croix. The number would also, of course, correspond to anything from a satanic coven to Jesus and his 12 disciples. According to the post-1956 statutes, Sion had a total membership of 9,841, ranked not in 7 grades, but in 9. The structure seems to have remained essentially the same, although it was clarified, and 2 new grades had been introduced at the bottom of the hierarchy, thus further insulating the leadership behind a larger network of novices. The Grand Master still retained the title of Notonnier. The 3 Princes Noachites de Notre-Dame were simply called Sénéchal. The 9 Croisés de Saint-Jean were called Constables. Apparently, for official bureaucratic and legal purposes, 4 individuals were listed as comprising the Council. 3 of the names were unfamiliar to us, and quite possibly pseudonyms. One name, however, we had encountered before. Pierre Plantard, born March 18th, 1920, Secretary General. While we continued our research, new Prairie documents continued to appear. As before, some appeared in book form, others as privately printed pamphlets or articles deposited in the Bibliothèque Nationale. Someone was obviously producing this material, but their objective remained unclear. At times we nearly dismissed the whole affair as a hoax of extravagant proportions. If this were true, however, it was a hoax that certain people seemed to have been sustaining for centuries. Whatever the motivation behind the Prairie documents, it was clearly not financial gain. Despite their commercial potential, they were confined to private printings, limited editions, and discreet deposition at the Bibliothèque Nationale. And the information that did appear in conventional book form seemed to issue from a single source. Most of it was based on the testimony of very specific informants, who measured out precise quantities of new information as if with an eyedropper, and according to some prearranged plan. Many of these fragments were released under different names. A superficial impression was thus conveyed of an array of separate writers, each of whom confirmed and imparted credibility to the others. There appeared to us only one plausible motivation for such a procedure: to attract public attention, to establish credibility, to engender interest, to create an atmosphere that kept people waiting with bated breath for new revelations. The Prairie documents seem specifically calculated to pave the way for some astonishing disclosure. And whatever this disclosure might eventually prove to be, it somehow involved the Merovingian dynasty, the perpetuation of that dynasty's bloodline to the present day, and a clandestine kingship. In 1977, a new and particularly significant Prairie document appeared. A six-page pamphlet entitled Le Cercle du Lys, written by one Jean de Laude. In the course of his text, the writer addresses himself explicitly to the Prairie de Sion, and although he rehashes much older material, he also furnishes certain new details about the order. In March 1177, Baudouin was compelled, at Saint-Léonard d'Acre, to negotiate and prepare the constitution of the Order of the Temple, under the directives of the Prieuré de Sion. In 1118, the Order of the Temple was then established by Hugues de Payon. From 1118 to 1188, the Prieuré de Sion and the Order of the Temple shared the same Grand Masters. Since the separation of the two institutions in 1188, the Prieuré de Sion has counted 27 Grand Masters to the present day. The most recent were Charles Nodier, from 1801 to 1844, Victor Hugo, from 1844 to 1885, Claude Debussy, from 1885 to 1918, Jean Cocteau, from 1918 to 1963. And from 1963 until the advent of the new order, the Abbé Ducos Bourget. For what is the Prieuré de Sion preparing? I do not know. But it represents a power capable of confronting the Vatican in the days to come. Monsignor Lefebvre is a most active and redoubtable member, capable of saying, "You make me Pope, and I will make you King." There are two important new fragments of information in this extract. One is the alleged affiliation with the Prieuré de Sion of Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre. Monseigneur Lefebvre, of course, represents the extreme conservative wing of the Roman Catholic Church. He was vociferously outspoken against Pope Paul VI, whom he flagrantly and flamboyantly defied. In 1976 and 1977, in fact, he was explicitly threatened with excommunication, and his brazen indifference to this threat nearly precipitated a full-scale ecclesiastical schism. But how could we reconcile a militant, hard-line Catholic like Monseigneur Lefebvre with a movement and an order that was hermetic, if not downright heretical, in orientation? The second major point in this extract quoted is, of course, the identification of the Prieuré de Sion's Grand Master at that time as Abbé Ducos Bourget. François Ducos Bourget was born in 1897 and trained for the priesthood at the seminary of Saint-Sulpice. He is thus likely to have known many of the modernists there at the time, and quite possibly, Émile Offet. Subsequently, he was conventual chaplain of the Sovereign Order of Malta. For his activities during the Second World War, he received the Resistance Medal and the Croix de Guerre. Today, he is recognized as a distinguished man of letters, a member of the Académie Française, a biographer of important French Catholic writers like Paul Claudel and François Mauriac, and a highly esteemed poet in his own right. Like Monseigneur Lefebvre, the Abbé Ducos Bourget assumed a stance of militant opposition to Pope Paul VI. Like Monseigneur Lefebvre, he is an adherent of the Tridentine Mass. Like Monseigneur Lefebvre, he has proclaimed himself a traditionalist, adamantly opposed to ecclesiastical reform or any attempt to modernize Roman Catholicism. On May the 22nd, 1976, he was forbidden to administer confession or absolution, and like Monseigneur Lefebvre, he boldly defied the interdict imposed on him by his superiors. On February the 27th, 1977, he led 1,000 Catholic traditionalists in their occupation of the Church of Saint-Nicolas-du-Chardonnay in Paris. If Marcel Lefebvre and François Ducos-Bourget appear to be right-wing theologically, they would seem to be equally so politically. Before the Second World War, Monsignor Lefebvre was associated with Action Française, the extreme right of French politics at the time, which shared certain attitudes in common with National Socialism in Germany. François Ducos-Bourget would not appear to be quite so extreme, and his medals at any rate attest to patriotic anti-German activity during the war. Nevertheless, he has expressed a high regard for Mussolini and the hope that France would recover its sense of values under the guidance of a new Napoleon. Our first suspicion was that Marcel Lefebvre and François Ducos-Bourget were not, in fact, affiliated with the Pruerie de Sion at all, but that someone had deliberately attempted to embarrass them by aligning them with the very forces they would, in theory, most vigorously oppose. There seemed to us a second possible explanation, a far-fetched explanation, admittedly. Perhaps Marcel Lefebvre and François Ducos-Bourget were not what they appeared to be. Perhaps they were something else. Perhaps, in actuality, they were agents provocateurs, whose objective was systematically to create turmoil, sow dissent, foment an incipient schism that threatened Pope Paul's pontificate. Far-fetched though our hypothesis might be, there was a coherent logic underlying it. If Pope Paul were regarded as the enemy, and one wished to force him into a more liberal position, how would one go about it? Not by agitating from a liberal point of view. That would only have entrenched the Pope more firmly in his conservatism. But what if one publicly adopted a position even more rabidly conservative than Paul's? Would this not force him into an increasingly liberal position? And that certainly is what Archbishop Lefebvre and his colleagues accomplished, the unprecedented feat of casting the Pope as a liberal. Whether our conclusions were valid or not, it seemed clear that Archbishop Lefebvre was privy to some momentous and explosive secret. In 1976, his excommunication seemed imminent. The press was expecting it any day, for Pope Paul, confronted by brazen and repeated defiance, seemed to have no alternative. And yet, at the very last minute, the Pope backed down. It is still unclear precisely why he did so, but the following excerpt from The Guardian, dated August the 30th, 1976, suggests a clue. The Archbishop's team of priests in England believe that their leader still has a powerful ecclesiastical weapon to use in his dispute with the Vatican. No one will give any hint of its nature, but Father Peter Morgan, the group's leader, describes it as being something earth-shaking. What kind of earth-shaking matter or secret weapon could intimidate the Vatican? Whatever it was, it certainly seemed to have proved effective. It seems, in fact, to have rendered the Archbishop wholly immune to punitive action from Rome. More recently, some of the issues surrounding François Ducos-Bourget seem to have been clarified. This clarification has resulted from a sudden glare of publicity which the Pruerie de Sion, during late 1980 and early 1981, has received in France. In August 1980, the popular magazine Bon Soirée, a kind of amalgam between a British Sunday supplement and the American TV guide, published a two-part feature on the mystery of Rennes Le Château and the Pruerie de Sion. In this feature, both Marcel Lefebvre and François Ducos-Bourget are explicitly linked with Sion. Both are said to have paid a special visit fairly recently to one of Sion's sacred sites, the village of Saint-Colombe in Nevers, where the Plantin domain was situated before its destruction by Cardinal Mazarin in 1659. By this time, we ourselves had established both telephone and postal contact with the Abbé Ducos-Bourget. He proved courteous enough, but his answers to most of our questions were vague, and he disavowed all affiliation with the Pruerie de Sion. This disavowal was reiterated in a letter which shortly thereafter he addressed to Bon Soirée. On January the 22nd, 1981, a short article appeared in the French press, of which it is worth quoting the greater part. A veritable secret society of 121 dignitaries, the Pruerie de Sion, founded by Godefroy de Bouillon in Jerusalem in 1099, has numbered among its grand masters Leonardo da Vinci, Victor Hugo, and Jean Cocteau. This order convened its convent at Blois on the 17th of January, 1981. As a result of this recent convent, Pierre Planton de Saint-Clair was elected Grand Master of the Order by 83 out of 92 votes on the third ballot. This choice of Grand Master marks a decisive step in the evolution of the Order's conception and spirit in relation to the world. For the 121 dignitaries of the Prieuré de Sion are all eminence grise of high finance and of international political or philosophical societies. And Pierre Planton is the direct descendant through Dagobert II of the Merovingian kings. His descent is proved legally by the parchments of Queen Blanche of Castile, discovered by the Abbé Sernière in his church at Rennes-le-Château, Aude, in 1891. These documents were sold by the priest's niece in 1965 to Captain Roland Stanmore and Sir Thomas Fraser, and were deposited in a safe deposit box of Lloyds Bank Europe Limited of London. Shortly before this item appeared in the press, we had written to Philippe de Charizet, with whom we had already established contact, and whose name figured as frequently as Pierre Plantin as a spokesman for the Prieuré de Sion. In reply to one of the questions we asked him, Monsieur de Charizet declared that François Ducos-Bourget had not been elected Grand Master by a proper quorum. Moreover, he added, the Abbé Ducos-Bourget had publicly repudiated his affiliation with the order. This latter assertion seemed unclear. It made more sense, however, in the context of something Monsieur de Charizet enclosed in his letter. Sometime before, we had obtained from the sub-prefecture of Saint-Julien the statutes of the Prieuré de Sion. A copy of these same statutes had been published in 1973 by a French magazine. However, we had been told in Paris by Jean-Luc Chamet that these statutes were fraudulent. In his letter to us, Monsieur de Charizet enclosed a copy of what were said to be the Prieuré de Sion's true statutes, translated from the Latin. These statutes bore the signature of Jean Cocteau, and unless it had been executed by an extremely skillful forger, the signature was authentic. On this basis, we're inclined to accept the statutes to which the signature is appended as genuine. They are as follows. Article 1. There is formed between the undersigned to this present constitution, and those who shall subsequently join and fulfil the following conditions, an initiatory order of chivalry, whose uses and customs rest upon the foundation made by Godefroy VI, called the Pious, Duc de Bouillon, at Jerusalem in 1099, and recognized in 1100. Article 2. The order is called Sionis Prioratis, or Prieuré de Sion. Article 3. The Prieuré de Sion has as its objectives the perpetuation of the traditionalist order of chivalry, its initiatory teaching, and the creation between members of mutual assistance, as much moral as material, in all circumstances. Article 4. The duration of the Prieuré de Sion is unlimited. Article 5. The Prieuré de Sion adopts as its representative office the domicile of the Secretary-General named by the convent. The Prieuré de Sion is not a secret society. All its decrees, as well as its records and appointments, are available to the public in Latin text. Article 6. The Prieuré de Sion comprises 121 members. Within these limits, it is open to all adult persons who recognize its aims and accept the obligations specified in this present constitution. Members are admitted without regard to sex, race, or philosophical, religious, or political ideas. Article 7. In the event that a member should designate, in writing, one of his descendants to succeed him, the convent shall accede to this request, and may, if necessary in the case of minority, undertake the education of the above designated. Article 8. A future member must provide for his induction to the first grade a white robe with cord at his own expense. From the time of his admission to the first grade, the member holds the right to vote. On admission, the new member must swear to serve the order in all circumstances, as well as to work for peace and the respect of human life. Article 9. On his admission, the member must pay a token fee, the amount being discretionary. Each year, he must forward to the Secretariat General a voluntary contribution to the order of a sum to be decided by himself. Article 10. On admission, the member must provide a birth certificate and a specimen of his signature. Article 11. A member of the prérédition, against whom a sentence has been pronounced by a tribunal for a common law offence, may be suspended from his duties and titles, as well as his membership. Article 12. The General Assembly of Members is designated the Convent. No deliberation of Convent shall be deemed valid if the number of members present is less than 81. The vote is secret, and is cast by means of white and black balls. To be adopted, all motions must receive 81 white balls. All motions not receiving 61 white balls in a vote may not be resubmitted. Article 13. The Convent of the Prérédition alone decides on a majority of 81 votes out of 121 members all changes to the Constitution and the internal regulation of ceremonial. Article 14. All admissions shall be decided by the Council of the 13 Rose-Croix. Titles and duties shall be conferred by the Grand Master of the Prérédition. Members are admitted to their office for life. Their titles revert by right to one of their children, chosen by themselves without consideration of sex. The child thus designated may make an act of renunciation of his rights, but he cannot make this act in favour of a brother, sister, relative, or any other person. He may not be readmitted to the prérédition. Article 15. Within 27 full days, two members shall be required to contact a future member to obtain his assent or his renunciation. In default of a deed of acceptance, after a period of reflection of 81 full days, renunciation shall be legally recognized and the place considered vacant. Article 16. By virtue of hereditary right, confirmed by the preceding articles, the duties and titles of Grand Master of the Prérédition shall be transmitted to his successor according to the same prerogatives. In the case of a vacancy in the office of Grand Master, and the absence of a direct successor, the convent must proceed to an election within 81 days. Article 17. All decrees must be voted by convent and receive validation by the seal of the Grand Master. The Secretary General is named by convent for 3 years, renewable by tacit consent. The Secretary General must be of the grade of commander to undertake his duties. The functions and duties are unpaid. Article 18. The hierarchy of the prérédition is composed of 5 grades. First, notonnier. Second, croisé. Third, commandeur. Fourth, chevalier. Fifth, écuyer. Article 19. There are 243 free brothers called preux, or since the year 1681, Enfants de Saint-Vincent, who participate neither in the vote nor in convents, but to whom the prérédition accords certain rights and privileges in conformity with the decree of January the 17th, 1681. Article 20. The funds of the prérédition are composed of gifts and fees of members. A reserve, called the patrimony of the order, is settled upon the Council of the 13 Rose-Croix. This treasure may only be used in case of absolute necessity and grave danger to the Prairie and its members. Article 21. The convent is convoked by the Secretary-General when the Council of the Rose-Croix deems it useful. Article 22. Disavowal of membership in the prérédition manifested publicly and in writing without cause or personal danger, shall incur exclusion of the member, which shall be pronounced by the convent. Text of the Constitution in 22 articles, conforming to the original and to the modifications of the convent of June the 5th, 1956. Signature of the Grand Master, Jean Cocteau. In certain details, these statutes are at odds both with the statutes we received from the French police and with the information relating to Sion in the Prairie documents. The latter shows a total membership of 1,093, the former of 9,841. According to the articles just quoted, Sion's total membership, including the 243 children of St. Vincent, is only 364. The Priory documents, moreover, establish a hierarchy of seven grades. In the statutes we received from the French police, this hierarchy has been expanded to nine. According to the articles quoted, there are only five grades in the hierarchy, and the specific appellations of those grades differ from those in the two previous sources as well. These contradictions might well be evidence of some sort of schism or incipient schism within the Priory de Sion, dating from around 1956, when the Priory documents first began to appear in the Bibliothèque Nationale. And indeed, Philippe de Cherizet alludes to just such a schism in a recent article. It occurred between 1956 and 1958, he says, and threatened to assume the proportions of the rift between Sion and the Order of the Temple in 1188. According to Monsieur de Cherizet, the schism was averted by the diplomatic skill of Monsieur Plantard, who brought the potential defectors back into the fold. In any case, and whatever the internal politics of the Priory de Sion, the order, as of the January 1981 convent, would seem to constitute a unified and coherent whole. If François Ducos-Bourget was the Priory de Sion's Grand Master, it would appear clear that he is not so at present. Monsieur de Cherizet declared that he had not been elected by the requisite quorum. This may mean that he was elected by the incipient schismatics. It's uncertain whether he is subject to or in violation of Article 22 of the statutes. We may assume that his affiliation with Sion, whatever it may have been in the past, no longer exists. The statutes quoted might seem to clarify the status of François Ducos-Bourget. They make clear, anyway, the principle of selection governing the Priory de Sion's Grand Masters. It is now comprehensible why there should have been Grand Masters aged 5 or 8. It's also comprehensible why the Grand Mastership should move, as it does, in and out of a particular bloodline and network of interlinked genealogies. In principle, the title would seem to be hereditary, transmitting down the centuries through an intertwined cluster of families, all claiming Merovingian descent. When there was no eligible claimant, however, or when the designated claimant declined the status offered him, the Grand Mastership, presumably in accordance with the procedures outlined in the statutes, was conferred on a chosen outsider. It would be on this basis that individuals like Leonardo, Newton, Nodier, and Cocteau found their way onto the list. Among the names that figured most prominently and recurrently in the various Priory documents was that of the Plantard family, and among the numerous individuals associated with the mystery of Saunière and Rennes-le-Château, the most authoritative seems to be Pierre Plantard de Saint-Clair. According to the genealogies in the Priory documents, Monsieur Plantard is a lineal descendant of King Dagobert II and the Merovingian dynasty. Throughout the course of the inquiry, we have repeatedly encountered Monsieur Plantard's name. Indeed, so far as release of information during the last 25 years or so was concerned, all trails seem to lead ultimately to him. In 1960, for example, he was interviewed by Gérard de Sède and spoke of an international secret concealed at Gisors. During the subsequent decade, he seemed to have been a major source of information for Monsieur de Sède's books on both Gisors and Rennes-le-Château. According to recent disclosures, Monsieur Plantard's grandfather was a personal acquaintance of Béranger Saunière, and Monsieur Plantard himself proved to own a number of tracts of land in the vicinity of Rennes-le-Château and Rennes-le-Bain, including the mountain of Blanchefort. When we interviewed the town antiquarian at Sternay in the Ardennes, we were told that the site of the old church of Saint Dagobert was also owned by Monsieur Plantard, and according to the statutes we obtained from the French police, Monsieur Plantard was listed as Secretary-General of the Priory de Sion. In 1973, a French magazine published what seemed to have been the transcript of a telephone interview with Monsieur Plantard. Not surprisingly, he did not give very much away. As might be expected, his statements were elusive, cryptic, and provocative, raising, in fact, more questions than they answered. Thus, for example, when speaking of the Merovingian bloodline and its royal claims, he declared, "You must explore the origins of certain great French families, and you will then comprehend how a personage named Henri de Montpassat could one day become king." and when asked the objectives of the Prieuré de Sion, Monsieur Plantard replied in a manner whose evasiveness was predictable. "I cannot tell you that. The society to which I am attached is extremely ancient. I merely succeed others, a point in a sequence. We are guardians of certain things, and without publicity." Needless to say, we became increasingly anxious, as our research progressed, to make Monsieur Plantard's acquaintance. There did not at first seem much likelihood of our doing so, however. Monsieur Plantard appeared to be untraceable, and there seemed no way whereby we, as private individuals, could possibly locate him. Then, during the early spring of 1979, we embarked on another film about Rennes Le Château for the BBC, who placed their resources at our disposal. It was under the auspices of the BBC that we at last managed to establish contact with Monsieur Plantard and the Prieuré de Sion. Initial inquiries were undertaken by an Englishwoman, a journalist living in Paris, who had worked on various projects for the BBC and had acquired an imposing network of connections throughout France, through which she attempted to find the Prieuré de Sion. At first, pursuing her quest through Masonic lodges and the Parisian esoteric subculture, she encountered a predictable smokescreen of mystification and contradiction. One journalist warned her, for example, that anyone probing Sion too closely, sooner or later, got killed. Another journalist told her that Sion had indeed existed during the Middle Ages, but no longer did today. Our researcher at last established contact with Jean-Luc Chamet, who had interviewed Monsieur Plantard for a magazine and written extensively on Saunier, Rennes Le Château, and the Prieuré de Sion. He was not himself a member of the Sion, Mr. Chamet said, but he could contact Monsieur Plantard and, possibly, arrange a meeting with us. According to Monsieur Chamet, the Prieuré de Sion was not, strictly speaking, a secret society. It merely wished to be discreet about its existence, its activities, and its membership. The entry in the Journal Officiel, Monsieur Chamet declared, was spurious, placed there by certain defecting members of the order. According to Monsieur Chamet, the statutes registered with the police were also spurious. Monsieur Chamet confirmed our suspicions that Sion entertained ambitious political plans for the near future. Within a few years, he asserted, there would be a dramatic change in the French government, a change that would pave the way for a popular monarchy with a Merovingian ruler on the throne. And Sion, he asserted further, would be behind this change, as it had been behind numerous other important changes for centuries. According to Monsieur Chamet, Sion was anti-materialistic and intent on presiding over a restoration of true values. These values, he explained, were ultimately pre-Christian. Despite Sion's ostensibly Christian orientation, despite the Catholic emphasis in the statutes. Monsieur Chamet also reiterated that Sion's grand master at that time was François Ducos Bourget. When asked how the latter's Catholic traditionalism could be reconciled with pre-Christian values, Monsieur Chamet replied cryptically that we would have to ask the Abbé Ducos Bourget himself. Monsieur Chamet emphasized the antiquity of the Prieuré de Sion, as well as the breadth of its membership. It included, he said, members from all spheres of life. Its objectives, he added, were not exclusively confined to restoring the Merovingian bloodline. And at this point, Monsieur Chamet made a very curious statement to our researcher. Not all members of the Prieuré de Sion, he said, were Jewish. The implication of this apparent non sequitur is obvious, that some members of the order, if not indeed many, are Jewish. And again we were confronted with a baffling contradiction. Even if the statutes were spurious, how could we reconcile an order with Jewish membership and a Grand Master who embraced extreme Catholic traditionalism, and whose close friends included Marcel Lefebvre, a man known for statements verging on anti-Semitism? On the whole, Monsieur Chaumet's answers were less answers than they were bases for further questions, and our researcher did not know precisely which questions to ask. She made considerable headway, however, by stressing the BBC's interest in the matter. A BBC film which emphasized and authenticated certain facts would certainly have been attractive. It was undoubtedly that which prompted Monsieur Chamet to telephone Monsieur Plantard. Eventually, in March 1979, with our BBC producer, Roy Davies, and his researcher functioning as liaison, a meeting was arranged between Monsieur Plantard and ourselves. When it occurred, it was held on neutral ground, in a Paris cinema rented by the BBC for the occasion, and all parties were accompanied by an entourage. Monsieur Plantard proved to be a dignified, courteous man of discreetly aristocratic bearing, unostentatious in appearance with a gracious manner. He displayed enormous erudition and impressive nimbleness of mind, a gift for dry, witty, mischievous, but not in any way barbed repartee. There was frequently a gently mused, indulgent twinkle in his eyes, an almost avuncular quality. For all his modest, unassertive manner, he exercised an imposing authority over his companions, and there was a marked quality of asceticism and austerity about him. He did not flaunt any wealth. His apparel was conservative, tasteful, insouciantly informal, but neither ostentatiously elegant nor manifestly expensive. As far as we could gather, he did not even drive a car. At our first and two subsequent meetings with him, Monsieur Plantard made it clear to us that he would say nothing whatever about the Prairie de Sion's activities or objectives at the present time. On the other hand, he offered to answer any questions we might have about the Order's past history, and although he refused to discuss the future in any public statements, on film for example, he did vouchsafe us a few hints in conversation. He declared, for example, that the Prairie de Sion did in fact hold the lost treasure of the Temple of Jerusalem, but he dismissed it as incidental. The true treasure, he insisted, was spiritual, and he implied that this spiritual treasure consisted, at least in part, of a secret. In some unspecified way, the secret in question would facilitate a major social change. Monsieur Plantard echoed Monsieur Chaumet in stating that, in the near future, there would be a dramatic upheaval in France. Not a revolution, but a radical change which would pave the way for the reinstatement of a monarchy. This assertion was not made with any prophetic histrionics. On the contrary, Monsieur Plantard simply assured us of it, very quietly, very matter-of-factly, and very definitively. After three meetings with Monsieur Plantard and his associates, we were not significantly wiser than we'd been before. We received no indication of Sion's political influence or power, or that the men we had met were in any position to transform the government and institutions of France. And we received no indication of why the Merovingian bloodline should be taken any more seriously than the various attempts to restore any other royal dynasty. There are several Stuart claimants to the British throne, for example, and their claims, at least so far as modern historians are concerned, rest on a more solid basis than that of the Merovingians. There are numerous other claimants to vacant crowns and thrones throughout Europe, and there are surviving members of the Bourbon, Habsburg, and Romanov dynasties. Why should they be accorded any less credibility than the Merovingians? Again, we considered dismissing the Prairie de Sion as a minor lunatic fringe sect, if not an outright hoax. And yet, all our own research had indicated that the Order, in the past, had had real power and been involved in matters of high-level international import. Even today, there was clearly more to it than met the eye. There was nothing mercenary about it, for example, or exploitative in any way. Had Monsieur Plantard so desired, he could have turned the Prairie de Sion into an extremely lucrative affair, like many other fashionable New Age cults, sects, and institutions. Yet most of the seminal Prairie documents remained confined to private printings, and if Sion itself did not solicit recruits, not even in the way that a Masonic lodge might, its membership, as far as we could determine, remained rigorously fixed at a precise number, and new members were admitted only as vacancies occurred. Such exclusiveness attested, among other things, to an extraordinary self-confidence, a certainty that it simply did not need to enroll swarms of novices, for financial gain or any other reason. In other words, it already had something going for it. Something that seems to have enlisted the allegiance of men like Malraux and de Gaulle. But could we seriously believe that men like Malraux and de Gaulle were intent on restoring the Merovingian bloodline?